It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Dookie Hong and Matt Robard spent 2 years visiting America's best Korea towns. Yes, they ate tons of barbecue, kimchi, bibimbap. But what dish do people in the know order in a Korean restaurant?
I think kolbijim is one that really doesn't roll off the tongue like bulgogi, but kolbijim is a braised short rib dish. So it's not that fiery, funky kimchi broth dish. It's more of a mild, it's sweet, it's sweetened with orchard fruits and dates and soy and mirin and lots of garlic, and it's just one of our favorites.
Hungry yet? Hope so, because there's lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef Enrique Olvera has been making news in his native Mexico City for 15 years. Many call him the greatest chef in Mexico. Others say he's an iconoclast. At his restaurant there, Pujol, he's rethinking Mexican food. Well, recently he's taken the giant step of opening his first United States restaurant, Cosme, in New York City. We met up at our 20th anniversary show on stage at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. Enrique is fit with black hair, close-trimmed beard, intense dark eyes, and his arms are laced with tattoos. One arm devoted to his family, the other to his food. We settled in to talk. So, Enrique, your Mexican food is not like any Mexican food most of us ever see. And I remember eating at Pujol, and I have to tell you honestly, I'm always skeptical when I hear about a restaurant in a place with an incredible wealth of cuisine that goes back thousands of years, and someone says, there's this restaurant doing absolutely new Mexican food, and I think, oh my God, here we go again. You know, it's going to be Mexican ingredients with French techniques, and it's not going to taste like either one. And I went to Pujol, and you did a version of the corn stew elote. Is that it? Yeah. That I had just had early that morning in the market. Special corn was just coming into season. And the thing that blew me away was it tasted like that corn in the market, but it was as though the chorus of all those different types of corn had been totally harmonized and Mozart had turned them into this aria in my mouth.
Oh, wow.
It's true. I was blown away. You know, it was like, at last. So I'd like you to explain your food, your Mexican food.
I completely agree with you. When I travel, not only in Mexico, but in general, I like to go to the markets. I like to go to the casual restaurants. But I also love the discovery of a new flavor and the discovery of a new sensation. Mm-hmm. And when we cook, we try to have those two things in mind. The power of tradition and that strength in flavor and that soul and that history that has been carried in those flavors, but also the fact that I love tasting something new. So, for example, with tortillas, we figured we want to make the best tortilla that we can. And I remember telling one of my sous chefs that is from Oaxaca, Luis, I told him when he jumped into the restaurant, I told him, your job will be to get the perfect tortilla. And he looked at me and he's like, you're crazy, no? Like, you brought me from Oaxaca, no, to Mexico City, and you're making me do tortillas. And he didn't understand at that point the importance of tortillas because it was so close to him and so personal that he didn't think it was special. So first we started just adding flavor to them. There's 60 varieties of corn that are native to Mexico, the 60 families, I should say. And then there's crossbreeding between those families, so the combinations are almost endless.
Oh, my.
So in the beginning, we started talking about corn like you would talk about wine, right?
Yeah.
So if you never go to a wine bar and say, like, I'll have a glass of wine. No, you have to tell them a little bit more information. Tortillas is the same. You can't talk about corn tortillas and flour tortillas. You need to talk about which kind of corn, if it's yellow, red, black, purple, even green. Where is it coming from? If it's a cónico, which is like, cónico means like a, it's like a cone.
Yeah.
Bolita, which is like a little ball. Those are the families.
Mm-hmm.
And which town does it come from? Because it is an expression of terroir. And if you pay attention and if you smell it, you can actually smell the difference. And obviously when you put it in your mouth, you can taste the difference. So that's the first approach. And then once you get that understood, then you can start combining flavors into the tortillas with nixtamalized, which is a process by which you make corn.
That's where lime is added to the corn.
Yes, the lime.
And it loosens the very hard skin on the corn.
That's right.
But it also adds that almost perfume that we always smell.
Exactly.
When we smell.
Yeah, that's like, to me, that smells like home. No, that's like my favorite thing to smell. Yeah. I could wear that all the time if I could. I don't know.
I totally understand.
I kind of smell like that anyways when I go home. So. but that nixtamalization process, you can apply it to different things. No? In desserts, it's traditionally done with papayas and with squashes.
Really?
Yeah. So we started nixtamalizing other things, like apples, and then it's beautiful because then you can make apple tortillas that will go well with pork, right? Apples and pork is a good combination.
Right, right.
So we try to think a little bit like this. Of course, we try to be respectful, but I also think this generation of cooks and any generation of cook has a responsibility to create new recipes, no? At some point, somebody made a tortilla, somebody made mole, somebody made chiles en nogada.
Yeah.
We need to keep generating those recipes. And if we don't play with our food and we're going to fail most of the time and most of the things will not last for a long time because that's just the dynamic of creativity.
Yeah.
But maybe one day, in a few years, somebody will create the new taco al pastor.
Can you briefly explain what mole is? Because to me, it's one of the crowns.
Mole is everything. Mole is a sum of everything that I think a cook can aspire, no? Which is to put a lot of things together and come up with a new flavor. And that's what mole actually is. No, it's the complexity of simplicity. And how something that is so baroque can be also very powerful. And that's why we like serving it on itself. We've reheated this mole for almost 800 days now. And usually mole is made for weddings, right? So the next day, you reheat whatever you have left over. And it's like turkey in Thanksgiving. It's always better the next day.
Right, right.
So mole is the same thing. So we just keep reheating and reheating. We add new mole every week or every 2 weeks. We make new mole and then put it into the old one because the old mole is so tired of being reheated.
But probably very lush, too.
Yes, yeah. It needs a little of the new mole.
Enrique, thank you.
Thank you so
this
much.
This has been fascinating.
Thank you.
Enrique Olvera's book is Mexico from the Inside Out. Now, Enrique left us with a recipe for the Mexican classic, Divorced Chilaquiles, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. You will also find an extended video version of that interview I did with the charming Enrique. We were on stage at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, and we had a ball. Find it at splendidtable.org. When it comes to seafood, scallops are high on the list of what's not to love. Instead of any hint of fishiness, scallops taste clean and fresh and meaty. When beautifully seared in a hot pan, they become sweet and creamy on the inside and crackly on the outside. To master cooking the ideal scallop, a little science from Molly Birnbaum goes a long way. Now, she's executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Molly is arming us through our ongoing partnership with the science behind the fundamentals of cooking. Our producer, Sally Swift, asked her to talk scallops.
Hey, Molly Birnbaum, nice to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I've been buying scallops lately, and I realize I know so little about them. What part do we actually eat of the scallop?
So scallops are really fascinating, surprisingly so. The part of the scallop that we actually eat is called the adductor muscle, which is one small part of the scallop as a whole. It's the muscle that helps it open and close its shell. But there are many more parts of the scallop, ones that we never see in the actual grocery store, including the mantle and the roe, the reproductive glands. Scallops have eyes. They have more than 100 eyes right around the mantle at the edge of their shell.
Wow.
Each one with its own lens, retina, and optical nerve. I know, it's fascinating.
It's really interesting.
And scallops swim. So when we started researching scallops at America's Test Kitchen, I went down the rabbit hole of YouTube videos of scallop swimming, and there's a surprising number of them. And scallops can open and close their shells pretty quickly to escape from predators. So they swim in a slightly awkward, slightly graceful, kind of very cute way. But they swim up into the water and then fall back down slowly. So their adductor muscle, the one that we end up eating, has a very strong purpose, which is moving them around in the water.
Okay, so when we shop for scallops, I often see the only thing I see, they call them wet scallops. What's the difference? What are we looking at when we're buying scallops?
So there are generally two types of scallops that you can see at the store to buy, and that is wet and dry scallops. And there's a big difference, and at America's Test Kitchen, we have pretty strong opinions on which ones that you should be buying. But wet scallops are treated with a solution of water and sodium tripolyphosphate, or STPP, which preserves them as soon as they are harvested at sea, and then they're often frozen. And so this preserves them, but it also helps them to hold on to a lot more water weight. And dry scallops are scallops that are not treated in this way.
And which are better?
Dry scallops, hands down. The STPP helps retain moisture in the scallops, but it also imparts a kind of soapy taste and a bouncy texture after they're cooked. So we really don't prefer them. And actually, when we started researching scallops for a book that we're working on, we, of course, being America's Test Kitchen, decided to try it out ourselves. So we tested a number of scallops by soaking them in a solution of STPP ourselves and then freezing them, thawing them, and cooking them to see how they were. And they weren't that good, to be honest. They had a lot more water in them. They weighed a lot more. When you cook them, they release a lot more water because there is so much more water trapped within them. And releasing water when you cook them prevents them from getting that good brown crusty sear on them because there's so much moisture. Dry scallops haven't been treated in that way. They are a little bit sweeter and fresher tasting, much more preferable.
Okay, often they're not marked dry or wet. So how do we know what we're buying when we're buying? Is there a test?
Well, first ask. I think that's always the first best step. If you are at home with a bunch of scallops and you're not sure if they're dry or wet, there is actually a test that you can do to determine for yourself, which is putting a scallop on a paper towel on a plate in the microwave, microwaving for 15 seconds. If they're dry scallops, there'll be very little moisture released on the paper towel. And if they're wet scallops, there'll be a noticeable ring of water around the scallop. You can still use that scallop to cook. Either way.
And is there any way to freshen up wet scallops or any trick to making them a little bit better?
Yes, we do have a little hack to help make wet scallops better, if that's what you're having, to kind of cover up that chemical flavor taste. And that is soaking them in 1 quart of cold water with 1/4 cup of lemon juice and 2 tablespoons of salt for 30 minutes. And you almost can't tell the difference.
So it's almost you're almost brining it.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So almost every restaurant these days have beautifully seared scallops on their menus. Can you give us an idea of how to do that at home? Is there a trick?
The trick is high heat. you pat the scallop dry so that it doesn't have extra moisture on it. You don't want that to kind of steam and prevent a good crust from forming. But high heat, you stick that scallop down in there and let it get a nice crusty brown Maillard reaction, delicious side to it. Flip it. Then we often add butter and kind of baste the scallop in a little bit of butter so it finishes cooking all the way through.
So you start with a really high pan and then put the scallop in and then don't touch, correct?
Don't touch.
Okay.
Exactly. You wait for that perfect crust.
It's hard not to touch our food.
It is very hard. You got to hold out.
I know. It's really rough. Molly, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Molly Birnbaum is the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, we have the details from Molly for the perfect pan-seared scallop. Find the recipe at splendidtable.org. Coming up, why do chefs flock to Koreatowns all over America when their work night is done? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it looks like Korean food is the latest it cuisine. Those funky, spicy, garlicky flavors have led to booming Koreatowns all over the country. These neighborhoods are now the after-work destinations for chefs and food lovers of all stripes. Well, our contributor, New York Times columnist Melissa Clark, got to walk through the basics behind Korean cooking and culture with the authors of Koreatown, a cookbook, Dookie Hong and Matt Rodbard.
Dookie and Matt, welcome.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
Hey, Melissa. So glad to be here.
You guys did a lot of running around the country, eating in different Koreatowns for this book. Matt, what was your favorite Koreatown that you experienced?
You're going to ask me to pick a favorite. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, no, what were some of your favorites?
Okay,
give a
thank couple. You. Thank you for stepping back. No, honestly, Los Angeles to me is the heart of Korean food and culture in America. As a journalist, I am blown away by when I go there because I go to these restaurants that specialize in single topic dishes. So there's a restaurant that does mandu, which is Korean dumplings. Walk down the street and there's a restaurant that does seolleongtang, which is bone broth. Walk down the street and you do a restaurant that does gamjatang. You've got all these great restaurants doing these single dishes so phenomenally well. To me, that it's almost like it's an expert level course in Korean food when you go to Los Angeles.
And Dookie, do you agree or do you have a different idea?
Well, first off, I think Maddie is officially banned from New York City's Koreatown.
And, oh, no.
And, you know, him being a New Yorker and saying that L.A. Koreatown is better is a little disturbing to me. I do agree with him in the fact that the food in L.A. is it's unmatched. It really is the best. We even go as far as to say that it's better than some food in Seoul.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, for me being a New Yorker, for me, there's nothing that can kind of match the energy and the culture and the people of just kind of walking on 32nd Street, seeing all the signs in Korean and just really feeling that energy on a Friday night, Saturday night. We've packed a lot of culture, energy, and a lot of just stories on that one block.
What are some of the things that people should know to get the best out of going to a Korean restaurant, say for a novice or for someone who's eaten in a few but really doesn't know a lot about Korean food?
Well, I think definitely order some soups and stews.
Okay.
It is like essential to understanding Korean food. Order a doenjang or kimchi jjigae. Maybe go with a lighter clam jjigae. Maybe, you know, there's lots of different soups and stews that are lesser known, but they're so delicious.
Yeah, I don't think people associate Korean food with soups and stews. And I know that you guys write in the book that, in fact, Koreans are the soup masters of Asia. Dookie, do you want to speak about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we are known for kind of Korean barbecue, the bibimbap, the stone bowl, but people forget that we're a peninsula. You know, we eat a lot of seafood. Also, we're avid noodle lovers and avid soup lovers.
You should definitely look beyond the grill. That's the one thing mm-hmm. we want people to take away from Koreatown.
Are there any dishes that insiders order that you have to be in the know to get?
I think Colby Jim is one that really doesn't roll off the tongue like bulgogi, but Colby Jim is a braised short rib dish. Mm-hmm. So it's not that fiery, funky kimchi broth dish. It's more of a mild, it's sweet. It's sweetened with orchard fruits and dates and soy and mirin and lots of garlic.
Mm,
and
that sounds great.
It's beautiful. And in our recipe, we actually do it in a crock pot, which is very much Americana. Mm-hmm. The crock pot was invented in Chicago in the 50s. So we really wanted to merge both Korean food culture and American food culture with that dish. But you can get it in restaurants. And it's just one of our favorites.
You know, let's talk a little bit about cooking Korean food at home. So what are some of the master sauces and condiments that people should know about and should have in their pantry?
Well, so Korean food is actually very simple. It's not as complex as many people think. Our basic flavor and our foundation of cooking, or our mother sauces, it's called changs in Korean, which are fermented paste, fermented sauces, soybean paste, chili paste, soy sauce. And that really is the foundation of a lot of the dishes that we create. I would say a fermentation and that deep kind of that, you don't really know what it is, but that layer of umami that you get, it's only developed through months and months of just fermenting and controlling that fermentation. You know, a lot of people call it, you know, the Korean miso or whatnot, but it's actually very different than miso in that Japanese miso, it's inoculated with Aspergillus oryzae. So you're kind of forcing that process of fermentation.
Uh-huh.
Koreans, we develop naturally, and that's why it takes longer. It takes minimum months to make a proper batch of soybean paste.
Oh, that's interesting. So they're also, it's like a wild fermentation, like almost like a sourdough
Absolutely.
Bread kind of thing. You're just getting
exactly.
the thing from the atmosphere. Now, so those are the pantry staples that people might have to go to a specialty shop to buy. But there are also a lot of Korean pantry staples that you can buy in the supermarket. You know, I know you use a lot of ginger and garlic.
Mm.
The jangs can be kind of difficult to find. You have to find a Korean grocery or an Asian grocery. But really, when you look at the larder, it's so common. You're seeing garlic, ginger, scallions, sesame oil, mirin, soy sauce. You're seeing things that you're going to cook with if you're cooking Chinese cuisine, you're cooking Japanese. You know, we wanted to break down, and this is Dookie's skill, is breaking down the cooking into simpler steps using this pared-down larder. And, you know, once the books have been out a few weeks, we've seen photos on Instagram. People have been sharing recipes, and it's coming from all sorts of backgrounds. So it's really cool that people are actually cooking this food, not just reading the book.
Yeah, that's another question I have. So, Dookie, why do you think Korean food right now is becoming very popular among non-Korean chefs? I mean, it's almost like it's becoming the next it cuisine.
For me, even just on a culinary sense, talking to chefs, we realized, Maddie and I going traveling and talking to and meeting all these chefs, we realized this is the food that they've been eating for a long time. They've have prior experiences and they love Koreatown. This is where they go eat after service. And they're incorporating it a lot, even into their own menus.
Yeah, and it's like a chef's nature to explore. You know, chefs want to explore the next cuisine. And as Dookie was saying, these chefs, we feature recipes from Sean Brock, Stuart Brioza, Eric Repair. They're riffing on the flavors of Koreatown. They're taking them back to their kitchens. And we're seeing this new generation of Korean and non-Korean chefs that are cooking beyond the taco with kimchi on top. You know, it's not fusion cuisine. It's really traditional flavors.
Right, but they're taking it into their non-Korean kitchens.
And
doing their thing. Thank you guys so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Dookie Hong and Matt Rodbard are the authors of Koreatown, a cookbook. Melissa Clark is a food columnist for the New York Times. Dookie and Matt left us with an unusual recipe for short ribs braised with stone fruit. It's called Crockpot Kalbi Jim, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. Twelve years ago, UNESCO, which is the educational, scientific, and cultural wing of the United Nations, launched the Creative Cities Network, developed to recognize global cities of gastronomy. Currently, UNESCO has designated 16 such cities, some of which are places you might expect, like Parma, Italy, and Phuket, Thailand. But in the U.S., the only city to have received this recognition is perhaps surprising. It's Tucson, Arizona. Well, to find out why this unexpected choice by UNESCO, our contributor, Von Diaz, tracked down one of the city's local champions, Gary Nabhan. Gary is an ethnobiologist, conservationist, and farmer, and Tucson's been his home for decades. Today, Nabhan heads the Center for Food and Regional Studies at the University of Arizona.
Hi, Gary. Thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be here with you, Von.
So what's up in Tucson?
Well, we are delighted that something we've been working on for years has finally borne fruit, and that's becoming the first UNESCO City of Gastronomy in the United States and one of just six cities in the UNESCO Creative Cities Network in the entire country. And this means that we can really celebrate our traditions and heritage with food, but also continue to foster the incredible innovation and vitality we've seen in Tucson over the last few years.
And what does it mean to be a global city of gastronomy?
Well, we're part of a creative cities network of 116 cities in some 54 countries around the world that interact through scholarly and other kinds of exchanges of food artisans, for example, chefs and farmers and and bread makers and cheese makers. And this brings us into dialogue with other innovators around the world so that we can not only jumpstart new innovations in our own city, but evaluate them and see whether they can be transferred to other U.S. cities as well.
Paint me a picture of Tucson.
Well, Tucson is a place I deeply love. I've been living in it off and on for 40 years, and it has a 4,100-year-old continuous history of agriculture inside the city limits with Native American groups, Hispanic communities joining in about 300 years ago, and then now over 60 immigrant groups that have made Tucson its home. So at our Tucson Meet Yourself Festival in the fall each year, we have 100 to 120,000 people eating the foods of 50 different ethnicities around the region and the world. And so this town just lives and celebrates every day with its great food and its great farming traditions. And one in six jobs here in Tucson are related to food and farming.
Wow, that's surprising. So what are the foods and dishes that make Tucson, Tucson?
Well, they are different from the Tex-Mex borderlands cuisine and even from the Santa Fe southwestern cuisines. We really have a border culture here that's this fusion of Yaqui and Tohono-O'odham indigenous traditions. Those groups live within Metro Tucson's area, as well as Hispanic and sort of Anglo-cowboy traditions. And so the foods include things like a kind of enchilada that you can't see anywhere in the world more than 50 miles away from here called the flat enchiladas or enchiladas chatas, which are cheese-stuffed corn cakes that are made completely differently than other enchiladas. We also have Navajo churro sheep lamb chops and Corriente Criollo cattle beef in our restaurants every day of the week, and they're the oldest livestock breeds in North America. And then we have wild foods that sometimes reach beyond the region but are celebrated here like nowhere else, the wild chiltepín, the hottest chili in North America. Choya cactus buds. Imagine eating the flower bud of a spiny cactus and finding it delicious. And things like mesquite pods and other wild foods that may not be known past this region but are integrated almost every day and week into something done at a restaurant, cafeteria, elderly home, or homeless shelter here.
Wow, and that all sounds delicious. How did you wind up in Tucson?
I'm of Arab-American descent. My family is Lebanese and Syrian, and I think I was pulled to this desert, even though I also love the deserts in the war-torn areas of the Middle East. And there's something about the pungency of the herbs and other plants that occur in desert climates, the essential oils that give them this powerful fragrance are actually enhanced by the hot, dry climates here. So we have a wild oregano here that is about 20 times more potent than any other oregano in the world, and high in antioxidants, but more than that, high in flavor and fragrance. So there's something special that I was just pulled to, being of desert descent, in this, the Sonoran Desert, one of the great deserts of the world.
Gary, congratulations on this amazing recognition. I'm certainly proud to have a global city of gastronomy in this country.
Well, all of Tucson is celebrating because everyone, every culture in this community made it happen. So thank you, and come and visit us.
Absolutely.
Ethnobiologist Gary Nabhan heads the Center for Food and Regional Studies at the University of Arizona. Von Diaz is a writer and food editor, a feat in two worlds. You never call my name. It is time for your calls. Let's connect any way we can. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Pick up the phone. Call us. 800-537-5252. Kathy's calling from Minneapolis. Hi, Kathy. What's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I know that I should eat more vegetables, but I really don't like them very much. So I'm looking for a recipe book for vegetable side dishes, preferably. And a bonus if I could make them at work, like in the microwave or a toaster oven, or if they reheat easily.
Well, Joe Yonan, who is dining editor at the Washington Post, has done a book, Eat Your Vegetables.
Okay.
Probably what you've heard through much of your younger years.
Yes.
But it's a great book. Okay. The other thing is, I'm trying to think, Deborah Madison.
Okay.
Anything by Deborah Madison is going to feature really great vegetable recipes.
Okay.
And then you look at cuisines where vegetables are very important. You know, for instance, Madhur Jaffrey from India.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the work of Grace Young, brilliant Chinese food writer. And for Vietnam, Mai Pham. It's Maipham.
Okay.
And I love her recipes. She's a restaurateur, but her recipes are really simple.
Yeah.
And great ideas. Like, for instance, let's say you do a takeout and you do sort of a vegetable stew, like a ratatouille or whatever.
Sure.
What you can do with that is you can buy rice paper rounds. This is, you've probably had it.
Yeah.
Seen them. All you do is you dip them in hot water, under a faucet. Let them soften up. I do doubles. I overlap them.
Yeah.
And you put some of that filling inside, whatever it might be. And you roll it up, and then you use a Vietnamese dipping sauce, which is just fish sauce and sugar and a little bit of vinegar or fresh lime and a tiny bit of water. And you do that to taste. And you could sit there. First of all, you could have literally a cup of something that's left over that you like. And you could roll it up. And this would be a meal that'll keep you eating. You could like six rolls out of that kind of thing. And it's really a great way to make vegetables more appealing to you.
So, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, but I'd say first of all, check out Eat Your Vegetables because he's got a big variety of recipes.
Yeah, because like I said, I know I should eat more. I just don't like them very much. So.
Yeah, and I think, you can make that. Think about cooking vegetables the way meat might be cooked, how you can roast them with a marinade, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know it's tough, but once you get the knack of it, I think you can make them more enticing.
Okay.
All
right. That sounds
You sound
great.
Doubtful, but I'm gonna do a big sell on this girl.
All right.
Okay, Kathy, go for it.
All right. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You're welcome. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Coming up, more of your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we're talking to you this hour. Get to us at 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, too. But find us. And that's what Greg in Seattle has done. Hey, Greg, what's happening? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Yeah, I'm fortunate enough that I'm going to get to go on a sabbatical here with my family, and we're going to go over to Europe for a while. And I'm very into food, and my kids are into food as well. And we're kind of looking for interesting activities where tourists can kind of tap into the local food element that's, you know, not the traditional vacation, $5,000 for a week in some villa in Tuscany.
Yeah,
so interested in thoughts you have.
Are you thinking maybe of even cooking classes?
I mean, all sorts of things. Cooking classes would be interesting. I mean, just finding local, you know, artisans, kind of any and all places and ways to plug in and find out about it.
Oh, you're singing my song. Okay. I think the first thing you want to do is you want to rent a place. Even how long a time are you going to be away?
We're going to be gone a total of 6 weeks in a couple of different cities. So we're trying to rent places in different cities.
That's great. Think about, for one or two of those rentals, think about a small village, a small town where it's not hectic, you know, where people do sit in the square and drink coffee after work or have a drink, that kind of thing, because you'll visit the same places. You know, you'll go to the butcher, and before you know it, you know, ask questions and whatever. The butcher will probably get to know you. And, you know, you may say to the butcher that that salami that you have is just delicious. Do you make it, or is it made by someone, and I'd love to visit him? Or I'd love to find who is the cheesemaker that you like to work with and learn something from him. You see what I'm saying? It takes a little time. But yep. That's how you get passed on. It's just like anywhere else. You're someone who expresses curiosity and a real interest, and not everybody's going to respond to it. But when they do, they're probably going to be delighted to say, I'm going to call my friend. And okay. Or he's open always from blah, blah to blah, blah. You know, what I've done in cheese shops, for instance, in Italy, there was a cheese shop making the most wonderful burrata. You know, that's the mozzarella that's stretched. It becomes like a little purse, and inside it's cream and little bits of mozzarella. And that's from the south of Italy. And I went, and turns out it was a shop of just fresh cheese. And I asked, you know, do you make the burrata here? And the woman looked at me. She said, you know, sort of like saying, is the Pope Catholic? Of course we make it here. And I said, can I watch? I went early. I ended up spending half a day in the back watching her husband, you know, and talking with him. And where the language doesn't work, there's a lot you can do with food that communicates, you know. So I would say the cities are wonderful and they're a great experience. But in smaller towns, you're going to have more connection. Do you speak any of the languages in the countries you're going to be?
Some English, German, and some Spanish.
Okay. Because one of the things I love to do is I go into the busiest little shop, you know, grocery store, right, or market stand, shortly before lunch. You know, all the women in smaller towns are often still buying all the groceries to make lunch, the big meal of the day for the family. And I innocently ask, you know, I'm looking for a place with a really nice lunch, the kind of thing that people love to eat here. Where would you suggest? Now, usually debates break out. Or I'd love to learn more about this special sausage. Who would you suggest that maybe I could visit? And you're going to end up with people bending over backwards in many cases to give you information and to connect. And, you know, it takes a little courage because you're the American and you don't speak the language well. But generally people think, oh, look, you know, this guy really wants to get into this. Poor man can't speak the language, but let's help him out anyway. So that's what I would suggest.
Sounds great. Thank you.
You are welcome. And have a great trip. 800-537-5252. We have Julia calling from Washington, D.C. Julia, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I just moved into a new apartment. It's my first apartment by myself.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I am planning on hosting a big housewarming party. about 30 people, uh-huh. and there's not a lot of places to sit in my apartment. So I want to do some finger foods, stuff I can make ahead of time that people are really going to enjoy.
Okay. And you don't want to have to spend a long time in the kitchen, right?
Well, I actually don't mind. Cooking is my favorite hobby. So if it's particularly difficult, that's all the better.
Okay. Well, one of the things that's kind of fun to do, you take any kind of pie dough. And if you want to, you can add fresh herbs to it or even dried herbs, but fresh herbs are lovely. And then what you're going to do is you're going to roll it out and you're going to cut it into strips about an inch and a half wide and maybe 2 or 3 inches long. And then what you're going to do is on the side, you're going to mix up shelled pistachio nuts, salt them to taste if they're not salted, and you're going to lightly crush those. You're going to do some minced onion with them, some lemon, and some raisins, and a little bit of garlic. And some people like to throw minced salami in with that. That's your filling. And the idea is that you take those strips and you just put a bit of that filling and then you roll them up like a little jelly roll.
Oh, great.
And you can just freeze them on a flat surface and then put them in a bag. And before you bake them, you're going to brush them with some beaten egg and sprinkle them with salt and a little bit of sugar. So they're sweet and salty at the same time. Now, you could put any filling you want in there, but I love the idea of the nuts and the garlic and the raisin and the onion and all of that. So that's one thing you can do. And you could do a bunch of those with different fillings if you'd like. The other thing that's fun to do, I know it's been done for years, but I am grateful when I see it. And that is arrange cut vegetables really so they really look great. Like they look like bouquets and have all kinds of sauces that you can dip into them. Because that fresh crunch when you're at a party and you're drinking and, you know, you're eating things that are often on the rich side, you need something fresh and crunchy. And maybe little fingers of chicken breast that you've rolled with lime and ginger and a little fish sauce and a tad of honey. And you put them on picks. It's that sort of thing that, boy, I've never tasted this combination before. Another thing I love is, and again, this takes no effort, get unripe mango, get jicama, cut them into sticks like French fries.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you do is you sprinkle them with red chili powder, salt, and sugar. And then you just, again, make like a bouquet. You put them in a shallow little container and you grab them with your fingers. And the recipe for that, by the way, is on the website, splendidtable.org.
Well, it sounds like I'm going to be having a tasty party coming up.
I think you are. There's lots of other things, but, you know, that's the kind of thing to kind of get you started. So have a great party and congratulations on your first home.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much. And I will shoot pictures over to the website so that you know it was a success.
Ah, we'd love to see them. You take care, Julia.
Right, well, you too.
Bye.
Thank you.
I remember my first apartment. Boy, I was the happiest person in all of New York City. Karen's calling from Reno, Nevada. Karen, welcome.
Hello, Lynn. Such a pleasure to talk with you. Here's our situation. Every August, I buy a lot of damson plums, and we make damson gin by putting them into a solution with sugar and gin and letting them macerate for a few months.
Oh.
And then we give it out at Christmas.
That sounds really delicious.
Old British tradition. I stumbled across the idea in an Agatha Christie novel when Miss Marple was taking a bottle of damson gin, homemade by her, to the vicarage.
You know, I've read Agatha Christie. How did I miss this? So what's the question then? It sounds like you've got this nailed. I mean, and it's delicious.
It is. Everybody likes it. It's very sweet. And we are then left with, a gallon or 2 gallons of leftover gin-soaked plums that last and last and last. And I wonder if you might have some recipe ideas as to how to use them.
Well, you know, there is a wonderful dessert that's done in the south of France, but it's done with prunes.
Yeah, well,
right?
This might translate.
Yeah, exactly. And they're soaked, if I recall, in something like, I'm not sure if it's red wine or maybe port. But the idea is you want to get rid of the raw alcohol taste.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although it's modified by the sugar.
Oh, all right. Then we don't have a problem. How do they taste?
Oh, they taste like sugary plums with gin.
Oh, they sound delicious. Okay. This basic idea of this dessert is that you take like a cake pan or a pie plate. You brush it with melted butter so nothing's going to stick. And you take a sheet of phyllo dough. And you brush that with melted butter. This is rich, by the way. You sprinkle it with cake crumbs, okay? Mm-hmm. And then you put another sheet. One sheet's going in one direction. You do a sheet across it. And you do that for about four sheets. You're making a crust. And by the way, you could do ground nuts, coarse ground nuts between each layer, which is even more delicious.
And rich.
And rich, of course. The idea is you have four or five of those sheets.
Okay.
You have taken those plums and you have put them in a sauté pan and you have just lightly sautéed them, maybe with a little bit of butter, cinnamon, and if you think they need more sugar, and a bit of lemon.
Oh, lemon. Okay.
Yeah, because you're cooking off a bit of the alcohol.
Right.
You'll make sure they're fairly dry. You'll drain them in a sieve over a bowl.
Okay.
And then they go into that crust and then you do the same thing on the top.
Okay.
All those layers, and then you brush all of those, bits of phyllo that are sticking out, and you can fold them over. If they've dried, still brush them, break them off, and pile them on top.
Oh, a crusty.
Because you're going to finish that top layer of phyllo with butter, and you're going to sprinkle it with a bit of sugar. And so you're making these wonderful crispies on the top. And then you bake it, and you bake it at 375. You want to make sure the phyllo is really crisp and the crust at the bottom is really crisp.
Uh-huh.
And remember, you can serve this cut. So if you slide a spatula underneath to see if that crust has gotten browned and you tear anything, no one will know because when you put this out, you'll have pre-cut it. And it will look like nothing. I mean, nobody will know.
Yeah, I love that idea.
This is a lovely, lovely, lovely thing.
Sounds scrumptious.
Yeah, it really is. It's delicious. So give it a shot. Okay?
Wonderful. Thank you.
You are more than welcome. Take care, Karen.
Thank you.
Bye. We have Victoria calling from Bozeman, Montana. Victoria, that is the most gorgeous country.
It is wonderful here, Lynn.
I gather you called with a question. I mean, I'll talk scenery forever, but...
Well, Lynn, my husband and I make mead, and we would love to have a mead tasting with our friends.
Right.
But I would like to serve some food with it, and I have no idea what to pair with mead.
Well, you know, I've had mead, over the years several times. It's fermented from honey, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. But it's not always super sweet, if I recall.
Ours is on the dry side. We have three different varieties that we do with a tasting, and they range from a real light pear mead that has a very mild sweetness,
right.
To a middle sweet rhubarb, and a really fresh berry mead that is a little less sweet than the rhubarb, but sweeter than the pear.
Well, first of all, think this, okay? One of the things that is the counterpoint to sweet flavors is salty ones, which means this opens up some possibilities here. You could do, for instance, popcorn with a little bit of chili butter on it. And you see that the salt and that little bit of kick played against the sweeter one. It would really be an interesting combination. Now, for something more substantial, I think, again, I'm going to spice, but fatty. Something like a local sausage, which could really be dynamite. And, there's that – this goes back to the 50s, I think. But there's that thing about taking, meatballs that have a lot of flavor or a sausage that you've cooked. And what I do with my sausages is I heat them up. I poach them in red wine. And then I boil down that wine with the fat from the sausage, of course, and it gets a little syrupy. So then if I want to, I can grill the sausage, but it's already cooked, so I can throw it on a grill or whatever the last minute to heat it up and give it a brown edge. But the idea is that syrup that you mix with grape or apricot jam and you roll this, you have that out coating the sausage. And that combination with the mead should really be interesting. And then you could do things that are really delicate for the pear mead. And that could be leaning toward fruit. I mean, why not serve pears with something that has a pear undertone?
Yeah.
I think, you know, something very simple with a bit of cheese. Because cheese is going to work with all of this. And you want something like a sharp cheddar or something that has a creamy edge to it. I wouldn't go as far as something really funky, you know, like something strong. And by the way, don't knock cream cheese. That could be a great thing that you could spread on whatever you want to spread it on. And you could put herbs in it or you could put fruit in it. But that could be the accompaniment with the pears. And then people can taste all of these things, you know, and do their own mix and match.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I think it would be fun.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Enjoy the mead tasting. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us. You have a great week. And let me leave you with this thought from Lily Pulitzer, who said, despite the forecast, live like it's spring. SplendidTable.org has just about everything you will ever need. And if you love what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. And for a daily dose of food inspiration, make sure you're following us on Instagram and Pinterest. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.